House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 14th, 2011.
We can condemn federal property.
First, I...
No, that's a regular one. Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. First up, we do have an LC up for introduction as a bill. That is LC 294, or 2954, pardon me, dated 2/11/11.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
I move that LC 2954, dated February 11, 2011, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Garrett is asking we introduce House Bill 2954, dated February 11, 1911, as a committee bill.
1911.
Representative Olson might have been here then, but I don't think you were, Mr. Chair.
In his second term of office at the time. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
I don't wear glasses.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2702.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2702 modifies the DUII diversion program, which is currently described in ORS 13200, to make some special provisions for individuals who are engaged in active military service. This bill would extend the period of time for diversion allowed for those people who are engaged in active military service, permits persons staying in active military service to appear to show cause hearing telephonically, or if the nature of their service prohibits them from appearing telephonically, to have a show cause hearing stayed until such time as their service no longer creates conflict. It also allows these individuals to satisfy the terms of their obligation under diversion by completing a comparable treatment program conducted by or authorized by a government entity in another jurisdiction.
Thank you. Call first Teresa Douglas. I think it's Jesse Barkin, I believe, and Gail Meyer, please. You can go in any order, just identify yourself for the record.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm a practice here at the state of Oregon. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar's Military Assistance Panel. I have been for the last 8 years. Although I have to mention I'm not here, this is not a bar-sponsored bill, or it's actually not even one that the Military Assistance Panel could formally endorse. Well, I do know that the members of the Military Assistance Panel do support this legislation. The bill concept actually was came to everyone's attention last summer in the context of a case of a department attorney named Shannon Mortimer, who had a DUI client who was being called on active military service, otherwise would have been eligible for DUI diversion, but was ineligible because of his active duty service. It created a problem with him getting into diversion. He brought the matter that Mr. Mortimer brought his client's problem to the attention of Representative Ben Cannon, who brought it to the bar's attention, and here we are. But the bill would, as Mr. Knott pointed out, what the bill would do is authorize trial courts express authority to accommodate active duty service members' service so that they are not exempt or excluded from DUI diversion owing exclusively to their active duty military service. And that's really the main thing about it. I know that there's some amendments that the governor's advisory committee on DUI has suggested. Also, the Oregon District Attorneys Association has some suggested amendments. The main amendment that the ODAA is concerned with is really nailing down. There's one aspect of this bill that allow person to participate in a diversion program if they're stationed somewhere else, if their active duty service puts them somewhere outside of the state of Oregon, they would be able to do their DUI diversion program outside the state of Oregon. Like, for example, if they're in Fort Gordon, Georgia, quite likely there's a DUI diversion program around that military base that's comparable to one that they would engage in the state of Oregon. They would be allowed to do that diversion program in this place nearby Fort Gordon, Georgia. so that they could get the diversion program requirements, get their diversion program requirements out of the way while they're on military service, so that when they come off active duty military service, they don't have this DUI charge hanging over their heads any longer. They have it out of the way. But in order to be able to, under the main terms of the bill, this part of the bill that allows trial courts to accommodate service members charged with DUI, to accommodate their active duty military service so that they can get into a diversion program, the DA's Association wants to ensure that the service member, in order to get that accommodation, has to be able to show that there will be no diversion program available to him at his place of active duty assignment. So, for example, if he's going to be stationed at Forward Operating Base Restrepo in Afghanistan, there's not going to be a diversion program there. So that military or that particular defendant should be able to have his diversion program accommodated while he's on active duty service. So we just really wanted to have a public hearing today on this bill and then work later with some amendments and then come back to the committee once we have the amendments hammered out. And unless the committee has any questions for me, I would stop there.
Any questions? And thank you. Thank you for all the work you did for the guys. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Parker. I appreciate that.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, committee members. My name is Teresa Douglas. I'm here as a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And I also have worked with diversion clients since 1984. The issue that I have run across with the military personnel is when they are put on active duty and are not available to attend a treatment program, or they are someplace where treatment is not available. During that period of time, their 1 year on diversion time is still ticking. And so a lot of times, by the time they come back from their deployment, their year is gone, and they only have a 180-day extension available to them. And in most cases, that is not enough time to get a full program done. We do work with people that are out of state. That I have never found that to be a stumbling block. There are programs available in other states. They are willing to accommodate Oregon's requirements. And I, as the evaluator, would be monitoring that and making sure that it complies with Oregon's requirements. So that's not the issue. The issue is more that when they're deployed, they're not available to do the treatment. And so we are hoping that this bill, the amendments, will kind of clarify it for the courts of how we can somehow freeze their time while they're on deployment, when they're not available for treatment, in order to give them a fair chance to complete diversion. I have seen military personnel, they're off serving their country, and they cannot complete it within the 18 months that is available, and they get convicted of their DUII, and I think that's an injustice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'd like to thank Mr. Barton and others for working on the bill. We heartily support it, and my good sense is from hearing everyone else that we'll be able to get amendments to satisfy everyone's concerns, and we'll bring the bill back in a final form, hopefully soon.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you, panel. Dr. Harmerode and General Caldwell, please.
Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. We're in support of this bill. We've been working to make it a little tighter in terms of some amendments. Those will be forthcoming, and I think the other panelists did just fine, so I'll stop now.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and mine will be short, too. We wholeheartedly support this concept. We think it'll work out well for some of the incidences that we have with our soldiers, particularly on deployments, and should make life a lot simpler for all those involved, particularly us in managing the force. So we support it very much so.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, this doesn't affect their responsibility under military law, correct? Still face the DUII?
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Winsett, no. In fact, typically what we find is that once they're mobilized into Title 10 service, they fall under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Prior to that, they fall under the state statutes, which we have an Oregon Code of Military Justice. So we have a means of dealing with those situations for discipline issues. In this case, if they have an incident that they're hanging over them at the time, we typically don't deploy those individuals, and so they can't move with their unit, even though they're into this program. Whereas if they could get an extension, then they can deploy with their unit. So it isn't like a double jeopardy situation where they can actually be punished once by the civil courts and then again under either UCMJ or OCMJ.
Thank you, General. But I think one of the previous testimony, Mr. Barton said we're talking about active duty that may be in this area and get a DUI, so they would still be subject to Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Mr. Co-Chair, you're absolutely correct. If they can have Uniform Code of Military Justice because of discipline issues and also because of the action that they got in a civil involvement.
My colleagues on the committee, I just want to make sure you realize that.
That's correct. If they're on Title 10 U.S., the Title 10 U.S. Code falls in, and they would be subject to that.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2702. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2781. Call Cena Squires, Larry Hatch, and Laura Wolf, please, first three.
Does he want to get Boone out of here?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think Representative Boone, I'm sorry, did you want to come up? 2741. I'm sorry.
I did say 81,
and I thought it just didn't connect.
41 then?
Yeah. Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2741 makes modification to ORS 403.225. This is the section of the statute that creates and manages the emergency communications account. This is an account that is designated by statute to pay for, among other things, the 911 system and other sort of associated expenses with the maintenance of the infrastructure to allow us to have an emergency communications system. This bill would make it clear as a matter of legislative intent that the contents of this fund are to be used for absolutely nothing other than that purpose.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Krieger. Happy Valentine's Day from Brian Clem's grandma. I brought this bill forward because of what has happened in the past and because of certain expectations of the people who benefit from the fund. And it's Deborah Boone, House District 32. The people in my district are rural, and there are a lot of rural firefighters, fire agencies, police agencies around, et cetera, around the state, and they depend on these. They do not have large operating budgets, and our and your lives when you visit our areas depend on the dispatch of the proper agency in a timely manner, et cetera. I have a lot of support behind me, so I'm not going to go into a lot of the details of this bill, but I did think it was important that I bring to you some information from my district, and it's a it's a resolution from the Cannon Beach Rural Fire Protection District, and they support this bill. They all have monthly meetings, and this was the one I got received by the time this meeting was being held. So I know that I have more coming in that will support this bill. I guess the thing that I would like to say is that people, like I said, they have an expectation of the money that they are spending or that is being charged to their, these are from the phone fees, the 75 cent per phone line per month. They expect that the money's going to be used for what it says it will be used, and it has been swept out in the past, and I have received the brunt of the anger of those people who do not approve of that. So that's why I did it. I hope you approve it, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the testimony.
Are there any questions for Representative Booth? Thank you, Representative. Okay, now we'll start over again. Hasina Squires, Larry Hatch, and Laura Wolf, please.
Great.
Remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Barker and Krieger. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, an entity that represents over 950 special service districts that provide services throughout the state of Oregon. Our largest member includes 300-plus rural fire protection districts who do not receive 911 dollars, but instead fund the 911 service via user fees. There are also several 911 special districts. Included in my testimony is just a little bit of additional background about the 911 system and how it came to pass. In 1981, the Oregon legislature issued a mandate for statewide 911. I just have to interrupt and say that Representative Olson was the president of the Oregon APCO NENA 911 Association, and it's odd that he's sitting over there. Anyway, in 1981, the Oregon State Legislature issued a mandate for statewide 911 service, and a 3% tax was instituted on subscriber telephone lines. In 1991, the legislature increased that surcharge to 5% and mandated that enhanced 911 service be provided throughout the state of Oregon, which would allow for automatic call lookup. In 1995, that 5% surcharge, which was fluctuating, was changed to 75 cents. Per device capable of accessing 911 services to provide greater revenue predictability for not only the state of Oregon, but for the local PSAPs, primary safety public answering points, of which there are 49 today in the state of Oregon. How those revenues are distributed, 60.5% of those revenues are distributed back out to cities and counties, and they are limited from using those funds for anything but PSAP operations unless they're directly related to 911 services. So we restrict our own local governments on what they can use the funds for. 35% of the funds are then distributed to the Office of Emergency Management for common network services, database, equipment, and other costs related to providing 911 via wireline and wireless 911 services. A lot of that 35%, the funds that are used under that 35% category are recurring costs. They're not things that are really optional. 4% of the costs are distributed to OEM to administer the program, and then 0.5% goes to the Department of Revenue. A little history on the diversions. There have been, since the inception of the tax, the legislature has diverted 911 tax a total of 6 times, beginning in 2001. 3 of those 6 times, either Governor Kulongoski or Governor Kitzhaber has vetoed that legislation as it has passed the legislature. So despite the fact that there have been 6 diversions, only 3 of them were successful and not vetoed by the governor. In 2001, House Bill 3977, there was a $1.75 million diversion of 911 dollars straight off the top of the account that was transferred to the Oregon State Police for computer, radio, and dispatch equipment out of their central communications office. That was allowed to go into effect. In 2002, House Bill, this was back when we had the 5 special sessions for there's at least 2 people here that were here during those 5 special legislative sessions. They were very special in 2002. House Bill 4020 proposed to divert $14 million from the 911 account to fund the state's general fund. Governor Kitzhaber at that time vetoed the bill. It was brought back in House Bill 4030 in the second special session. Governor Kitzhaber again vetoed the bill, and perhaps maybe he became weary because in the third special session, House Bill 4055, the amount was reduced to $9 million, and that was diverted to the state's general fund. Governor Kitzhaber did not sign that bill, but he did allow it to go into effect without his signature. And then in 2007, Senate Bill 994 and Senate Bill 5549, it was a combination piece of legislation, would have diverted $9 million to the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, commonly referred to as OWIN. Many of you have heard about that recently. Governor Kulongoski did exercise his line item veto on that piece of legislation. And then finally, last legislative session, Senate Bill 581, which was the part of the budget rebalance that we did at the beginning of the last legislative session, there was $3.61 million that was taken out of the emergency communications account, the enhanced account, and diverted to the state's general fund. In addition to that, last legislative session in combination, there are about $1 million in interest earnings on that emergency communications account. Those monies have also been diverted into the state's general fund and will continue to be diverted into the state's general fund unless legislation remedies that situation on a forward-going basis. I'd just like to quote one thing from Governor Kulongoski's 2007 veto message. I realize that he issued this veto message and then a couple years later allowed a diversion to go through, but he indicated that he was vetoing that $9 million for OWIN because it is important that funds collected from telecommunications customers for enhancements to the 911 emergency response system be used for the purposes established in the applicable statutes, and we could not agree more. Customers are told on their telephone bills, and wireless carriers and landline carriers tax their own customers to provide to get this money for the state of Oregon to distribute to the cities and counties, only to have the state legislature divert it. And it's wrong. It's just not truth in taxation. I feel sorry for the landline carriers and the wireless carriers that are taxing their people to provide these services, only to have the legislature then divert those funds. Also, the federal government feels pretty strongly about this also. In 2008, the Net 911 Improvement Act that was passed contained some language that it was encouraged to discourage additional diverse states diverting funds into general fund dollars. We are on the list of states that has diverted out of in the last biennium 911 dollars. There have been nine total states that have diverted funds. If you divert funds within a period of time before 180 days before you apply for one of these federal grants, you're ineligible. If you divert at any time when you have received a grant, you will become ineligible for the grant funding. So we're cutting our nose off to spite our face in some of those instances if we do apply for those grants. Just to reiterate, the telecommunications industry and the state of Oregon has spent a lot of time developing this state-of-the-art quality 911 system, and we believe that those taxes should be funding exactly those types of services and should not be diverted for state general fund use. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Hey, thank you. Are there any questions?
Co-chairs, committee members, I'm Larry Hatch. I'm the Legislative Committee Chair for Oregon Abgonina, and I'm also representing the Board of Directors for Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency. My testimony has a lot of what Asina had in hers, so I'm not going to repeat that. The interest, having that sent back to the general fund, that also hits us locally. I did some numbers last week before I wrote my testimony. That means about $49,000 a year to Washington County PSAP, with that money being sent into the into the general fund, and we'd like to see that come back. Also, we look at these funds. I think what made it a target for people to look at is that we did have money sitting there not spent, and that's because in the 911 industry, we were using that as our savings account because we have a lot of things facing us, and we like to be able to save up the money to pay for them. And right now, you may be hearing talk about next generation 911, NG911, and that's our ability at the PSAP to be able to receive text messages to 911, have photographs from the scene sent to us, and to be able to accomplish that, we have to put a new statewide network in, one that's capable of handling that kind of data. And then look at all the equipment in the PSAPs and make sure it's up to date and can receive that information. So Oregon Appomena urges you to support House Bill 2741.
I have questions, Chair.
Show my ignorance, I guess, but there's other examples of creating trusts where we can't get money once it goes in. Are there other examples of us creating trusts where us legislators cannot get at it? Anybody know the answer to that question? Thank you. I support the bill,
Mr. Co-Chair.
Just so you know.
Yes, Representative Olin.
I would hate to be quoted as having thoroughly reviewed this, but I do believe there are some trusts, but they are established in the Constitution or by the voters. Yeah. Now, there are dedicated funds. The Highway Trust Fund, for example, is established, and that's a constitutional protection.
Right.
There are other funds that are dedicated to certain purposes, but perhaps not statutorily in this way.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I support what you're trying to do here. I think if I pay a fee to the Ag Department or Fish and Wildlife or anybody else, that's where I'd like my... And I've personally swept funds with my vote, so... But I'm not interested in doing that anymore. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Representative Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for committee counsel, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but there's some language in this bill that indicates that it's a contractual obligation that the state is assuming. Has that type of language been used before, and if so, has it been effective to give a private right of action to prevent the state from sweeping funds like this?
And co-chairs, members of the committee, I personally have not seen this language used for this purpose before, but I wouldn't be confident saying that it can't be used for this purpose. I would be more than happy to take that up and get back to you.
Thank you, panel.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Barker, Figure, committee members. My name is Laura Wolf. I'm with the City of Portland's Bureau of Emergency Communications. We provide call answering and dispatch services for all the public safety agencies within Multnomah County and for the 725,000 residents. We receive approximately 3,000 telephone calls a day, or about over a million a year, and we receive approximately 17% of the annual distribution of 911 telephone funds. And I won't reiterate what Hasina and Larry have shared with you and Representative Boone, the reason for this. Any diversion of this dedicated 911 telephone tax has far-reaching implications. Although we have 911 within the state of Oregon, as Larry said, NextGen is on the horizon. You know, most of the today's youth and a lot of the population believe that they can reach a 911 center by text message, which was evidenced with the Virginia Tech slings. A lot of those people are sending text messages to 911 and they didn't go anywhere, as they don't go anywhere today. The City of Portland joins Oregon Appomena and the other public safety answering points and public safety agencies within Oregon to support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a question along the line of the 911 issue, but I noticed in testimony here from Hasina, and actually, Larry, you can address it because you've been around that a lot longer than she has been, that I know. The first bullet, I see that the PSAPs are down to 49 now, from what I remember, 60. So you've really, I mean, you've identified a lot of the efficiencies. How's this all play out now with the tax? I mean, are you still receiving about what you need right now for that amount? Or?
Co-chairs, Representative Olson, we are on probably an annual basis. There's PSAPs out there talking about consolidation or doing some things together to save money. When those consolidations do take place, the funds where they were going before go to that PSAP. I just reviewed our budget this morning, and we're at 19% is what the 911 tax covers in Washington County. That goes up and down depending on what jurisdiction you're in.
I actually, for council, echo Representative Wan's sentiment about the contractual language in here. It does seem a little misplaced.
Thank you, Pam. Kevin Campbell, Scott Winkles, and Brian DeLashmet.
Good afternoon. Chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. The testimony already has been very complete, so I want to echo our support for House Bill 2741. I want to mention that there is clearly in the public's eye an expectation of where the dollars will be spent. I don't think that's unclear at all. I would also mention that the cost to the system, the increase in call volume, the cost of continuing to have mandates that require mandates or migration to enhanced technologies and just the increased costs over the system mean that the interest that was swept last time cannot be considered extra money. And so it's valuable and very important to our members that the funds continue to flow. Otherwise, what happens is we end up having increased user fees, both for police and fire at the local level. I really appreciate that this conversation is going on because as you analyze the contract language and what that means and how binding it is, regardless of all of that, we're appreciative that the legislature is having this conversation about that. And I want to thank the committee and hope you'll support this bill.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. And again, I won't go over ground that's already been plowed, but I would like to elaborate a little bit on the federal implications of sweeps of the 911 funds. In 2008, Congress passed Public Law 110-283, which is commonly referred to as the new Emerging Technologies 911 Act. What that act required, it allowed states to tax voice over internet lines and cellular phones for 911 purposes, but required that those monies be spent specifically for 911. It also directed the Federal Communications Commission to conduct annual surveys of the states to determine who, if any jurisdictions have shifted those funds for other purposes. Again, Oregon is on the list. Our ability to attract those federal funds is now in jeopardy. By passage of this act, the League believes that we not only protect funds collected within Oregon for 911 services, but also protect our ability to attract federal and external funds for 911 services.
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, I'm going to wear multiple hats. I'll start off with the Oregon Council Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We believe that this bill is essential, obviously, for the reasons you've heard. Now I'll put my Sprint Nextel hat on, representing one of the providers. I'll echo exactly what Representative Boone said. She says that she catches the wrath when they do the sweeps. Well, if you can imagine, if you're a wireless telephone provider and your subscribers are paying this monthly fee, and then they read that the money's being swept, who do they call? We're the tax collector. They call us and say, what the heck's going on? We paid it for this purpose. So although the representative may hear the wrath, we hear it quite regularly, and we have taken a position that on behalf of our subscribers that we believe this is money that should go to the general purpose in which we've been assigned to collect it, and would favor this bill. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Eric.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, and this is a question, I believe, from Mr. Winkles. When you mentioned earlier that there's a federal program and that we'd be out of compliance if we continue to divert funds and that would threaten certain federal monies, do you have a sense of how much money we're talking about?
Mr. Co-Chairs, those are subject to annual federal appropriations, so it would vary widely. I can provide you the information from last year, and it's kind of up in the air right now what's happening with appropriations this year.
Brief follow-up. And thank you again, co-chairs, members of the committee. So were we considered out of compliance the last time that an evaluation was made?
Mr. Co-Chair, it's my understanding we were reported of having diverted the funds. I don't know that a specific ruling was made as to whether or not we were within or without of compliance.
Right. Thank you. And I'll anticipate those materials.
Certainly.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I think council has raised some good questions. We might want to get perspective from people directly involved in the management of the funds on those questions as well.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Pam. General Caldwell and Mary Botkin, please.
statement on the floor of the House because I have the material. I've seen it.
You get that mouse.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department and the interim head of the Office of Emergency Management, which 911 is part of, or that's part of our operations. As you were explained in the previous testimony, the division of the dollars and how it works, just kind of give you a little context. Out of the 35% account that essentially the OEM, the way we view this at OEM is that the 60.5%, which goes to the PSAPs, we're nothing more than a bank. And we, our job is to take those funds and distribute them down to the 49 PSAPs and get them the money as allocated in the law. The 35% account, which is typically an account that accumulates somewhere between $13 and $14 million annually, is designed to run the system and maintain the backbone of the system, which we control or we fund and make sure it's manageable. About $10 million of that per year is used for telephone line charges and ongoing costs. It's not a, you know, it does, but it does accumulate some monies that in that account that we use to purchase new equipment. And we're looking forward at the enhanced 911 system and trying to examine what those dollars are and what is the cost going to be. The direction from the governor, and we've had a conversation with him about this very task, is that clearly we want to move to enhanced 911 services so all the PSAPs can get everybody that's out there with a cell phone and can text and get those messages in and receive assistance, because presently we can't do that in Oregon. So if you're in the back of a car, thrown in a trunk, and you want to text somebody, you can't do it. Nobody will get it. 911 won't get it. So we're examining that right now. We have a study that we've just initiated at the first of the year, and we're looking at how are we going to do that and sustain the system for the next decade without coming to you and asking for an increase in taxes. Unfortunately, as you let the regular line costs go out on a monthly basis, and you accumulate those dollars in order to make these investments at the different PSAPs, not only to replace equipment, which lasts about 5 years, and also looking at how we're going to replace to this new enhanced 911 system. If you don't let those dollars accumulate, then you can't make these purchases. Now, back to the budget side to give you the context that I was speaking to. Sometimes, as these dollars accumulate, smart people that do numbers and don't run programs look at that and say, my goodness, look at all that money in there. They're sitting there with all this money and they're not using it, so we might as well get it and do something that we can use it for. Coupled with that, before we took over the Emergency Management Department, they had a situation where when they would go in and get their budgets put together, they couldn't, for whatever reason, couldn't manage to get through the legislative fiscal process the proper amount of allocation or as in order to spend the money. So, in essence, when people look for that snapshot in time during these tough budget situations, they did not have the allocation, the appropriation from the legislature to spend the money, so more money than should have been accumulated was being accumulated. When we first took over the department, the local governments were extremely up in arms about the fact that we were holding regular dollars that we couldn't execute to give them. So they were very upset about that. We came to the legislature, to an emergency board, and said we need limitation to spend these dollars. It's not our money. It belongs to the PSAPs. And we got it. So I think as you look at why people look at this account occasionally and say, my goodness, look at all those dollars in there, and they're not using it, they don't have a plan, and I'm not sure we articulated it or the previously was articulated very well to the legislature as well. So there was no vision at that point. So I think that's maybe some of the reason why you see these sweeps that consistently happened over this period of time. In March, we have committed to the Legislative Fiscal Office and our Ways and Means Subcommittee that we will hopefully give them the first, we will give them the first laydown of this decade plan to move to enhance 911 and show you and your colleagues exactly what this is going to create with respect to where the costs are and what we anticipate is going to be the total expense to move all of the 49 PSAPs into the enhanced 911, at the same time run the legacy system and convert. And I can tell you right now from our first blush that there isn't enough money in this account to do everything that needs to be done and get it done in a timely manner. I don't know the exacts. We have, a contract that we have a team doing that right now. And I suspect that when they come back in March and tell us exactly where we're at, we'll be able to come to you and show you graphically where these lines cross and what our next decade future is. So anything we can do to maintain these dollars in this account at this time will certainly get us to that point where we can get to enhance 9-1, maintain the legacy system, and keep this system going for the next decade. That concludes my testimony, and oh, by the way, I do support the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chairs, my name is Mary Buchan. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees this afternoon, and we represent those individuals who answer and dispatch 911 calls, and we have a very simple goal, and that goal is that regardless of where you live in the state of Oregon, when you pick up the phone or you pick up your cell phone and dial 911, that somebody somewhere can find you. If you're not able to tell us where you are, we want to know where you are, because we have enhanced the systems and that we have the best systems available, and that everybody in Oregon has the same right to access and can expect the same services. We support this bill. We were very upset when the funds were swept. Some of you know that already. If this will keep the funds from being swept in the future, then we are delighted, and we are supporting this bill in hopes that that's what will happen.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative
Wisniew? Mr. Chair, a question of the chairs. Is this bill to be referred to Ways and Means?
I was notified today that it will be a Ways and Means referral.
Do you know what the amendments? We've talked about amendments, but do you know what the amendments, other than what's been addressed today, is going to talk about?
I don't know.
Thank you.
We talked about amendments on the other bill, not on this one.
And I have a question with General, please.
Please.
General, thank you for your testimony. And I spoke on the floor last year with help of, I think, the Senate Squires against this and how it could jeopardize federal grant money. But it passed overwhelmingly. How much do we have in reserve now in this fund?
Mr. Co-Chair's representative, wasn't it? I don't have the exact number, but as I indicated earlier, the reserve basically accumulates as we collect the revenue every month from the Department of Revenue when the providers pay it.
Typically on an annual year, based on
our most recent look, is that we will accumulate somewhere between $3 and $4 million in excess of the ongoing line charges and the ongoing costs, and that money is what we use to designate out to replace this equipment and or go to E911. So I think on a biennial basis, you're probably looking at somewhere between, you know, 8 and maybe 9 million, which if you look at the sweeps that occurred in the past, that kind of follows that logic. It, you know, there was a chunk of chain sitting in there.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, please.
But General, who will make the decision and how we spend that money? In other words, is the military department, is the governor, does the legislative body have to say how we're going to split upgrades to 9/11? That will come back to the legislature to be approved. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, representing President, that is correct. As we go through our budget process, then we will detail out what our intentions are to take these dollars and how they're going to be spent. And again, it's back to a situation where I think we are chagrined in not being able to demonstrate to the legislative body on a very, you know, pointed plan of how do you plan to spend these dollars. And that's what our intent is to do once this study is done, is to be able to show exactly. We can show you now that we've got 49 PSAPs. We can show you when the equipment was replaced and when it's expected to expire, and what is that going to be, and what is it going to cost us roughly to replace that equipment.
Trying to
ascertain from this study is not only maintain this legacy system, but how much money out of this enhanced account are we going to have to go ahead and when we change the equipment out at its lifespan, how can we move into the next generation of equipment and also get there in a reasonable time frame?
Thank you.
so we don't end up with equipment that's non-functional or legacy equipment and not have the money to go ahead and not only replace it. We don't want to replace legacy. We want to move to E911. And that's exactly what we'll present to our budget committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is we've all heard, you know, this is important. We must do it. 911, as I get older, is very important to me in my life. We also remember our phone bills and still have funding for the Spanish-American War. And so my question is how much do we build up or, you know, things like that. So I'll talk to some of the general maybe in the lobbyist offline to see. But I don't know if we need to address that in the bill or not. You said there's no proposed amendments forthcoming.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Weather, I just my comment that, again, the 4% that comes off the top for administration, currently in the last biennium, we only expended 2.5% of that. We took 1.5, put it back into the 60.5% account to distribute to the locals. So we have tried diligently to keep those costs down to the bare minimum, and I think we've done a good job in that respect. When it comes to banking dollars, the really only banking of the dollars comes in that enhanced account where we try to set that aside to build up enough money to do these purchases. The rest of it is simply money in, money out. You know, we're simply a manipulate the money into the people that the law says that it will go to.
Thank you, Ms. Sherry. We have a 911 center in my district I've toured, and my daughter's actually listened in on it. But I once again, I voted to sweep funds. We were in a bind, and my friend didn't persuade me. I have since then been persuaded, and I'm not interested in reducing anyone's contractual packages either to balance our budget. But, Mr. Chairs, you're going to have to forgive me. I'll have to do it again. We have options in this state. We have not acted on them. They're relating to land use, water, timber, power, generation, distribution, mining. We have plenty of options. We're dripping in wealth in this state. And we're just looking, we have the golden land, the words in the songs today. Well, we also got the golden goose, and we're not doing any with it. But we have options. I'm hoping this session we do something about it together before we pass in these budgets. And thank you for bearing with me again, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, if I can just add, you know, this is one of those fees that I've never heard anybody complain about. You know, there is a clear nexus. People get it. They know what 911 is. I venture to guess there's probably not very many two-year-olds that don't know what 911 is and how to use it. You know, this is an option that is a great way to fund a critical system, and nobody ever complains to you when they pay that phone bill. Nobody.
I worked at one period of time in the old legacy 911 system where, as a supervisor, something would happen and they need to trace a phone call. I'd go physically pull a little chip out of a big wall full of wires, and it would take maybe 2 hours before we could find out where that was. And if somebody had just had a heart attack, that's a long 2 hours, and the enhanced really improved that quite a bit. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to let everybody else on the committee know that I'm seeing for my second round of the same witnesses today from an earlier bill in revenue. And what we're talking about in the revenue committee is how to capture revenues from prepaid calling cards and prepaid monthly cell phone users. And what I'd like to point out is that one of the things that makes that discussion very difficult with the providers to expand a tax or to make a fee to make it more broad-based is when people have concerns of trustworthiness with regard to how those monies are being used. And I can guarantee you when I'm sitting in a room with representatives from the industry and representatives from retailers, and they're saying to me, well, you want us to do it in this way or this other way, the question is always going to come up. The elephant in the room, so to speak, is how do I know the state isn't going to sweep this for other things? And so the point of my question to our committee council is to try to find the best way for us to be able to provide them with assurances, and because that's the best way to rebuild trust.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here on House Bill 2741. open a public hearing on House Bill 2781 and call Representative Thatcher and Representative Hicks, please.
You should not have this one, Carolyn.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from District 25, which includes Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And first, thank you for hearing the bill today. I think it's appropriate that we would choose today. I think it was probably not planned this way, but to have a celebration of states' rights on Oregon's birthday. So this is not just about Oregon. We see this movement across the country where different states are pushing back on federal government policies. Maybe you've heard about these pushbacks on health care or immigration or gun laws. There are several states that have adopted resolutions adopting sovereignty under the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And in fact, I think this committee is hearing a similar proposal in a couple of weeks to support the 10th Amendment. Of course, here in the wild, wild west, we've had a long-standing battle over land disputes that date back into the pioneer days. So perhaps this is, you can call this a modern-day revolt over land. Some of you may have been here serving during the Sagebrush Revolt of the 1970s. In the western region of the country, the 13 states that comprise this region, nearly 93% of all the federal land is in that part, is in the western region. In fact, half the land in the region is owned by the feds. Oregon has the fifth highest percentage of federal land in the country. That's about 53% of our land. And I have a handout for you today. It has a map. I thought you might find it interesting to see all the olive green blotches all over the map. That is federal forest land. The light beige is BLM land. And attached to the map is a list of all the country or the counties in Oregon and the percent of federal land. Congratulations, Representative Gene Wisnett. Your county has the highest percentage of federally owned land, nearly 80%. Yeah. Legislation is modeled after a law that was passed last year in Utah. It's kind of a similar situation. In Utah, the battle is over natural resources, as is, I think, here in this state, as Representative Schaffler kindly brought up a minute or so ago. In Utah, they were upset about land restrictions on federal land, which prevents them from developing oil and gas deposits. They can't get to their state holdings because federal lands have been declared off-limits to roads or other development, blocking access to those state lands. Others in Utah want the federal government to offer more leases on its land for oil and natural gas drilling. Now, similar to the situation we have in Oregon, these energy-rich public lands in Utah are supposed to be producing millions of dollars in tax revenue for schools. Here in Oregon, we talk mostly about timber production or the lack thereof, unfortunately, and most of it's on our federal forest lands. The federal government owns about 60% of the 30 million acres of forest land in Oregon. The federal government, or the federal policies regarding spotted owl and other regulations, have locked up much of this land, which once produced millions of dollars for Oregon counties and schools. Now, a few years back, the legislature started the ball rolling on a special federal forest land advisory committee, which they met for several years, and they issued their final report in the spring of 2009. Among the recommendations were some that called for more involvement by state and local decision makers to improve forest management on federal lands. Now, I think you'll hear from a couple of those decision makers today, and I really appreciate the committee's willingness to hear about this bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Wally Hicks. I represent House District 3. To pick up where my colleague has sort of left off, this bill, to my eye, it brings two issues before the committee for consideration. The first issue really goes to the heart of the posture of the state and its relationship to the federal government and the desired balance of powers between those two constitutionally empowered entities. The second issue, which I'm actually going to tackle first, is the particular language of the bill and whether this is the appropriate way of addressing it. And so turning now to the House Bill 2781, I have reviewed, for my own part, and I think some others have done the same, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution. And it doesn't, to my eye, seem that that's the relevant clause necessarily that we'd be dealing with, and perhaps if counsel had a view on that, I would welcome his input. But I would, if we were to go forward on this, and I strongly urge the committee to do so, I would actually strike all language that goes after "with the consent of the Legislative Assembly." So we wouldn't need "and in accordance with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution." That would, I think, also limit the court's interpretation of this statute, which is meant to be a much broader approach. That having been said, the situation here is that years and years ago, decades ago, the federal government and the state entered into a contract, and the arrangement was that the federal government was going to make up for lost prospective revenue that the state could be raising off of all this vast territory through a series of payments that the states could and have indeed come to expect over the course of time. Those payments are basically at an end. They are, by all indications, not going to be renewed, arguably then subjecting the federal government to a breach of contract considerations, and the state needs to have its plan in order should that situation come up. I have also presented this map here. This is the proposed Siskiyou Crest National Monument. You can see this is a map of my district and also a couple of others, which is being proposed by the administration currently to, it's about a million square, it's close to a million acres, and it's being proposed under the Antiquities Act to be turned into a national monument. What that means is that the federal government, and particularly the executive of the federal government, is able, at least through their interpretation under the Antiquities Act, with the stroke of a pen, without any congressional action, without consulting this body or any other body of the public such as this, to simply designate this as a national monument and thereby relieve the federal government, I submit, of any responsibility for payments under the ONC dollars. Why have they decided to stop paying? Because they're planning to do this instead. And my reading of the law is, you know, I think they're going to try and pull it off. And this is very concerning. This area of the state was once considered to be an amazing source of wealth. Mineral resources have been only barely tapped. We barely scratched the surface, so to speak, on the kind of minerals that are here, especially in terms of modern technology. The stuff that sustainable type of technology is made of is largely thought to be found right here, uniquely within the United States. I want to make the body aware that this is a trend that is only drifting decisions of this magnitude farther and farther away from where they were originally intended. It's extremely concerning in terms of the status of Oregon, of the United States as a whole, and I think this is an important decision for the legislature to make in terms of how it wants to go ahead for the many, many years to come. Thank you. I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Representative Schopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is drifting further and further and further from what people intended, not just this, our own land use laws in the state, Clean Air and Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. When they were all enacted, I don't think people could even dream of where it would end up going. I support the spirit of what you're trying to do here. We have been promised, we're part of the country too, we should be allowed to log
graze our cattle, mine on this property. I couldn't agree more, especially in light of the promises that were made and now are being reneged. If they try to go back on any promises we made with Native American cultures and sovereign nations in this country, we all know what will happen if they do that. But my question is, and I hope you don't take it as an unfriendly question, going all the way back to the Washington administration, the attempts to states to nullify a federal law or the establishment of a bank, I don't even know if they've ever had any success. I'll leave that to the legal scholars to tell me. I don't think there's great chances of accomplishing this. I don't want to discourage you because I think the message needs to be sent. Is there any model anywhere in American history where the state successfully nullified something of this magnitude unless there was a change in the law at the federal level? That's my question.
I'm not aware of any specific cases. I'm not the
legalese individual expert here at this particular table. However, I would say that this just does need to be, this serves as a point of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is time for the states to start pushing back on some of these things, especially where it intrudes on or affects our ability to run our own government in our state and take care of our own citizens. Because I think a lot of the policies that have come down are unfunded mandates at worst, and then just taking over of land and making it off limits to our actually producing and supporting an economy in the state.
And Representative, I agree with what you're trying to do here. I agree with you're exactly right. In my humble opinion, we just had the Department of Environmental Quality from Oregon and the Environmental Protection Agency regional manager in Business and Labor on Friday, and everyone in that room made it very clear that if these draconian water standards that will be the most stringent in the country are applied over this state, all kinds of businesses could and will go out because they won't be allowed to even. There's a variance in there, but they won't get any. And if these standards are so important for the safety, health, and welfare of America, why aren't they applying them to the entire country? The whole country should have the same water and air quality standards. I know why, and you know why. This is a soft spot. It's just the camel's nose under the tent. It's a start here, and I'm as frustrated as you are. I appreciate you bringing it forward, and you're right, we do have to have a conversation. Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Nolan? Co-Chair, thank you. Representative Thatcher, this is an intriguing bill. Can you explain how you envision this playing out should the legislature pass this bill? What action would you anticipate that the state would take? Because the bill just permits the state to move forward, but it doesn't actually make any movement forward. What do you think would be the next step?
I suppose that would be up to the administration in charge and what actions they would choose to take. I would say that, to make it clear, the allow does not apply to land that that was agreed to between the feds and the state to turn into federal jurisdiction. But maybe I would just defer to our lawyer here at the table as to what he anticipates.
And thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Nolan. The language of the proposed statute, as I'm reading it, would authorize basically a civil foreclosure action, similar to any other that the state government might undertake, to pursue damages that the state government can identify in a court of law to a judge and proceed basically along those lines. It would be an agent of the state, potentially the Attorney General, potentially some other agency who would file a foreclosure action in a civil type of manner, and the issue would be decided by a judge.
If I might follow up. I think I get the kind of concept here. My brain works best if I can wrap it around a specific example. Do either of you have an example of a piece of property that you would like the state to condemn? And then what would you have the state do with that property?
I don't I don't have a specific piece of property in mind, because it would also have to go through the sieve of whether this particular property had been agreed to between the federal government and the state government under the enclave
clause to go ahead and,
you know, we wouldn't do anything of that sort. But there are, I believe, there would be several locations that would be ripe for the picking, so to speak, under this law, that would also benefit the state and help with developing the economy and timber resources, et cetera, in the state. Now, you were, what was the second part of your question? Sorry.
I'm just struggling to put this into more concrete terms or more tangible terms. A specific property that might be a target for condemnation, and then a plan for what the state would do once it acquired the land.
Well, and I also want to make it clear, too, and it's my understanding that under condemnation you would have to pay fair market value for the land. So the state would have to be purchasing it. So there are things that would have to happen to acquire this land. First, it would have to meet the criteria of the law. Second, one would have to pay for it. One would, I'm sure, try to figure out as a, through the state agencies that do so, figure out if it's worthwhile to purchase the land, and then purchase the land and develop the resources that they're looking to develop. So I don't have a specific, say, this piece of land at, you know, this township range and section, but I would say that you can perhaps use your imagination of many different locations that might come under this description.
And
Representative Krieger?
What you are hearing is a lot of frustration about our relationship with the federal government because they're not accountable to anyone. The Biscuit Fire, you wanted to have an example of a piece of property, 500,000 acres, Curry County into Josephine, 5 billion feet of timber burn, rotting, putting CO2 in the air, not reforested. If that 500,000 acres belonged to Weyerhaeuser, the state of Oregon would be taking them to court for being in violation of the forest practice rules. It has hurt fish. It's going to hurt the economy long term. That land will never be, in the lifetime that we know, 200 or 300 years, depending on the environment and the weather, ever be reforested like it is today. It's hurt the watersheds in those areas. We all are, and the whole thing you're talking about, the federal government, you want to protect water. The biggest abuser of natural resources in the entire United States is the federal government, from lack of management. Sustainable management. And when you sustain something, you not only sustain the environment, you sustain the people and the communities that depend on it. It's amazing to me, if you were to look at the 18 timber dependent counties and you were to ask those county commissioners what's the biggest thing that we could do for them, they would tell you, get the federal government out of my land. And you talked about that you're going to have to pay for it. No, we own it. There's no authority, if you look at the Constitution, for the federal government to own the land for the purpose that they've got it. Go see what they can own land for. Talked about post offices, military reservations, and a couple other things. There's no other provision for them to own land at all that I ever saw. You know, I look at this thing and how it's interconnected. You talked about the meeting you had the other day with EPA people. We've got the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Act. We've got acts to protect birds, all of which we want to do to some degree. But they're not required to have unlimited numbers of these predators, for instance, that are eating up 50% of our smolts, and then the federal government lists the very fish, the salmon, that their predators are eating, and with no responsibility at all to manage anything. They go back and collect their $100,000 a piece or more as an employee and are accountable not to us or to anyone. I'd like to know who does really have the authority over that land. The question as to who's the chief enforcement officer in any county? Representative Hicks, do you know who that is?
Who the chief
enforcement officer in any county?
I think sheriff.
That's
if,
right.
If I'm gathering your question.
And about the time that our sheriffs start picking up these federal employees, booking them, throw them in jail, seizing their car, and saying, come talk to us, then we'll have their attention. And I would go there without batting an eye. I've put up with them from my days with the state police. I put up with them when I was on the Board of Forestry. I put up with them when I was on OWEB. I put up with them Bonneville administration wanting to come to my ranch and do a great big excavation of the ground looking for native artifacts. You know what I told them? Contact John Bishop, our sheriff, because they told me, well, we're going to bring these federal marshals over. I said, you know what's going to happen to your federal marshals? They're going to be arrested. The sheriff's going to take them to jail. We're going to fingerprint them, photograph them, put them in a cell, and we're going to take pictures at every point. They were told that. Guess who didn't show up? The federal marshals didn't show up, but they did call the sheriff to find out if he was going to do it.
Mr. Co-Chair, can I just make sure I understood the response, because this was actually getting to the specifics I was looking for. Is the intention then to move to the authority to condemn federal land in order to own it and operate it as a state facility? That's what I thought I heard the co-chair saying, that we wanted to operate forests as state forests instead of federal forests.
Can I make a comment there?
I'm trying to understand. Thanks.
The state right now has the Sun Mountain or Sun Over Your Country. It's got the Elliott Forest, and it's got the Clats of Potomac and a few other pieces. And I was on the Board of Forestry, and they're trying to develop that forest plan. And we were trying to accommodate all the federal rules on water endangered species. If the states actually owned the federal land, that does not mean that you're going to use it all, maximize every square inch of it, because some of it needs to be set aside. There's some water values, there's some high-risk sites. You're not going to operate on those, but the good land that you can, in an environmentally way, you know, manage that for timber, for mining, safely, use adaptive management, the newest technologies that come along. If we could do that as a state, and this economy starts coming back, we would be a wealthy state.
Yes.
We wouldn't worry about how many people we were incarcerating. We wouldn't worry about trying to fund K through 12 or worried about Oregon Project Independence. We would have enough money to do all those things because it would be coming to Oregon from what God gave us here. And you ever listen to a few lectures from my good neighbor down there? You understand.
I've listened to more than a few.
Yeah, I think we all have. And that's why I never interrupt him, because I want to make sure he gets it all out. But it's ridiculous to sit here and act like you're broke and you're sitting on a great big bunch of eggs that are full of, golden eggs. Nobody wants to cut the last tree, take the last piece of gravel out of a stream, catch the last fish. We want to do the opposite, because by managing and sustaining it, that will provide us in the future. It's like a farmer. Do you think he wants to, cut everything down to where his land can't produce anything? He's the person that's got to be the best steward of that land and to try to pass it on from generation to generation. That's what I'm doing with my tree farm. My tree farm was a national tree farm for the whole United States out of 73,000. It wasn't because we were cutting every tree down. It's because we were putting multiple species. We were educating people. We were staying off the land when it was muddy, taking care of the environment, recognizing that it's not just during my lifetime. It's got to be the lifetime of my family and the kids and the future generations for Oregon. If we allow people to do that, if we made the state do that, we wouldn't have the economic burden that we're carrying today.
Mr. Chair, we'll have to find money, build a jail, lock up all the federal people.
President Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to answer Representative Nolan's original question, the way that I looked at this is that it gives us the opportunity to have standing in court for a federal judge and the federal government to stand up and make their claim. Because in order to proceed with a condemnation, the person defending has to prove that they have valid ownership. And it's very difficult for us sitting here in Salem, Oregon, to find or have the opportunity to get into federal court to challenge the actions of the federal government on a property ownership basis without a vehicle to get standing. And that's the way I'm viewing this. And I don't know that this is the perfect vehicle to get standing, but I think that's part of the concept as well. It is, and Representative Shoffler, that's how in the past states have been able to challenge an action of the federal government, is by going to court making the constitutional argument and winning. And over the last 25 years in particular, there have been more instances of states being successful and successfully arguing that that the Congress has exceeded their authority than there have been in decades prior. So in a nutshell, that's the way I view this. And like I said, I don't know that this is the perfect vehicle, but it is a vehicle.
That leads actually to the question I was going to ask, which is if the proponents are aware, since this bill is patterned after something that's been done in other states, have they yet provoked an actual legal challenge? Is there a pending case yet that would shed light on whether this is a valid theory?
No, there isn't. I don't think that's been decided.
I don't think it has been decided.
It hasn't been decided.
Yeah, it is currently being discussed, I think.
Councilor Hazard, go ahead.
All right, thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, and members on the floor. The pending challenge is one that's expected to reach the Supreme Court. It comes out of Utah. There was in the run-up to the 1996 election, Bill Clinton designated the Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah. That's an area about the size of Delaware. And it was, by all accounts, it has substantial coal holdings underneath. It was controversial in the area at the time. The Utah bill is literally, I believe, word for word. Ours is modeled on, the proposed bill is modeled on that one. So where we're at right now is that the governor signed that into law. They announced that Staircase Escalante would be their sort of test case. They have a view for a legal challenge. They've already had to set aside $3 million in preparation to make that challenge. The ultimate end, to answer Representative Nolan's question, is that they would, from the invocation of eminent domain, basically they're just going to lease out the coal rights. It's going to be extraction licenses that they're looking to do. Beyond that, they wouldn't be administering the land per se. So the briefs have not yet been filed on that, but there is an anticipated challenge on the basis of an eminent domain that will very much be a test case, but likely an expensive one for this concept.
Mr. Chair, just on that note, I just wanted to say that every time I tell Representative Krieger or Schaffler that I agree with them on this stuff, they look at me with shock because I come from the city and I'm not supposed to understand, but I am very sympathetic to what you've said. And I don't know that I would support this bill because I think it is a highly uncertain legal theory, and I don't want to see the state spend a lot of money testing something that other states are testing. I'd rather have Utah take the case up, and then we'll find out if this thing has legs or not. But I appreciate the conversation.
Hey, thank you, panel. Next we'll call Carla Edwards, Patrick Perry, and Dave Honeycutt, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Barker and Krieger, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. My name is Carla K. Edwards, and I'm the Rural Policy Analyst for Cascade Policy Institute. We are a public policy research organization. HB 2781 takes a huge step forward, attempting to take control of Oregon's own destiny. More than 53% of Oregon's landmass is in federal ownership and thus off limits to any kind of private investment.
From 2000 to 2010, federal ownership of land in Oregon has increased by 2.5 million acres. This is according to the payment in lieu of taxes known as PILT payment records. The federal government has virtually eliminated commodity production on federal forests and grazing lands and continues to further restrict the uses of these lands. A few recent examples. Secretary of the Interior Salazar on December 22nd issued Order 3310, which will designate additional wild lands to the potential of 45 million acres throughout the nation. That is in addition to the already identified wilderness program. In addition, there's the movement to establish the Siskiyou Crest National Monument, which will essentially put another 600,000 acres off limits for many uses in Oregon. Both of these and many other federal management decisions in Oregon will further limit the ability to manage these lands for multiple uses and diminish the ability to generate any significant economic returns for the communities surrounding these areas. Federal land management decisions coupled with state land use laws have reduced more than 90% of non-urban lands in Oregon to what Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto refers to as dead capital. The poverty rate for rural Oregon in 1979 was 12%. 30 years later and today, it is 17.2%. This can be directly tied to key government interventions which have constrained free market principles in traditional areas of wealth creation, and more specifically to federal land ownership. Currently, rural residents in Oregon earn a dismal 75 cents for every dollar earned personal income nationally. From 2000 to 2009, 9 eastern Oregon counties have had a net loss of population, and 16 additional counties have been subject to below average growth. This is why creating economic opportunities through removing lands out of public ownership and putting them into private ownership is critical for Oregon. Though we fully support the attempt to assert Oregon State's rights, we believe there are further additional steps that should be moved forward at the same time as this piece of legislation moves forward. Unlike Utah, who passed this in 2010, Oregon has automatically approved of our federal forest lands transactions through ORS 272. ORS 272.040 addresses acquisitions of lands for national forests and retention of jurisdictions for certain purposes. Subsection 1 should be repealed for all future land jurisdictions, thus enforcing it to go through your legislative body for approval. Subsection 2 should be amended to address all federal lands, so not just federal forest lands, but all federal lands would be pertinent to this. This would require all acquisitions, including gifts, to be approved by Oregon's legislature to the federal government. In addition, we recommend adding a subsection to subsection 2, a sub D, which could establish concurrent management jurisdiction over those lands that are under federal ownership. ORS 272.050 requires the county governing body to approve acquisitions of national forests. This should also be amended to include all federal lands, not just forest lands, and for acquisitions in the future. In addition, we would recommend a work group be formed to identify all the federal forest lands that have been exchanged, gifted, purchased, or obtained through other means of acquisition without the consent of the county affected, as well as all lands that have not fallen within the definitions of OR 272 and therefore have not received the consent of Oregon as required. The work group should then identify the appropriate steps to move forward with the remanding of these lands back, just as a step that Representative Nolan was looking for. And finally, a joint resolution should be sent to Congress requesting that they begin to liquidate their land holdings in Oregon, with the short-term goal of federal ownership being less than 50% by 2015 and a longer-term goal further significantly reducing the federal land holdings in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this very important issue up to rural Oregonians, and look forward to having you address these issues so that rural Oregon can recover in this economy with the rest of Oregon.
Okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of this bill. I think I appreciate the questions that were raised. I think the way that this bill would work is it would simply authorize the executive branch in this state to condemn federal lands for whatever purpose the executive branch thought was in the best interest of Oregonians. The bill would also authorize the legislature, if the legislature wanted to, pass subsequent legislation that authorized a condemnation from it. The bill would authorize that as well. The Utah bill that passed last session will end up being challenged. It will go, obviously, to the United States Supreme Court. The Utah legislature has already authorized money to handle that that litigation. So you could just sit back if this bill passed and wait to see how that litigation turns out. But I think this bill sends an important message, and in fact, you may be able to get an amicus brief from the state of Oregon in that federal litigation if the legislature was to pass this bill and the bill was signed by the governor. We think it's a very important bill, very important for rural property, for rural communities, for rural economies. And as Carla said, in a number of rural counties, particularly in eastern Oregon over the last decade, while the rest of the state has been growing and while surrounding states have been growing, including rural populations in some of our neighboring states, in eastern Oregon we've had declining populations over the last decade, primarily because the jobs that were once there in the natural resources industries have dried up. This bill gives the state the opportunity to take federal lands, put those lands back into production, either as state-owned properties or alternatively to turn around and sell those properties, put them back into the private sector, and let private sector resource industries actually make use of the properties and employ Oregonians. So we think this is a great bill. And from a legal perspective, you have two U.S. Supreme Court cases, neither one of them very recent, one from 1917, that being the most recent, the other one from 1849, one saying that this appears to be authorized and one saying that this isn't authorized. So when you have the Supreme Court saying two different things in two different cases, with the 1917 case not even mentioning the 1849 case, that's typically something that's ripe for review by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're hoping that they'll take this case up in the Utah situation. We're hoping that this bill passes, and we're hoping that the state of Oregon will join Utah and vigorously defend this concept and get a ruling from the Supreme Court that really will help rural Oregonians.
Thank you.
I'm Mr. Perry. Chief Perry, Whittier County Commissioner, one of them little counties in the middle of Oregon. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2781 from the perspective of we're just about out of the federal board secure rural school funding loop. We started out 3 years ago at around $800,000, and next year it ramps down to just $20,000. That's the ramp down of the payments. And we're looking at in 2012 to be without road services, not being able to provide basic road services to our citizens and the citizens of Oregon and the citizens of the United States, because we have a of course, the Painted Hills Federal Park is in our county. We have lots of access to both the Umatilla and Oceanville National Forests. We maintain them access for the public. And we'll be unable to provide safe access to them without funding to be able to fund a road department. With our schools, of course, 25% of them funds go to our school also. We've put away, we're 23% owned by the federal government in Wheeler County, and we were able to put away money in reserves as far as catastrophic road reserves and equipment reserves, and we'll have burnt through them by the end of 2012. So back in the 1980s, we... but that's before my time as a county commissioner, of course. But the citizens of Wheeler County was put on a vote on the voting to vote on what percentage of Wheeler County citizens would like to take back their federal lands and manage them, not be managed by the federal government. And 73 or roughly, I'm not really sure if it's 73 or 74% of the public were in favor of taking back their federal lands at that point. I think you'd find that figure quite a bit higher today, especially with them knowing that their road department is about to cease to exist. Representative Nolan questioned how would you manage them lands, and I think the counties and the state could partner in certain management of the lands, not necessarily having all of them just be sold off to the private private entities, timber companies, special interest groups, however that you wanted to sale them, but to actually actively manage lands for the schools and for the infrastructure of the roads of both the state highways and county roads. I like the parable you used about it being a nest of golden eggs, and I would hate to see them eggs not harvested. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there any questions? Okay. Thank you. Any further business to come before the committee? Adjourned. Wallet.